in the winepress of Gath, do not tell it. Do not lament over it. At a house of dust, lament. At Aphrath, lament over it. Wallow in the dust. Take a dust bath as an act of mourning. That's Micah chapter 1, verse 10, from the version of Yours Truly from 2003. I just needed to get a little bit of lip balm. It's dry weather these days. And that was our daily scripture for today, little ones. So, children of the light, I want to review what we saw yesterday. We saw the Doppler shift, which when something's moving away from us, is a red shift. Now, may I also point out that for a constant velocity, if this light is moving at a, or this source of light is moving at a constant velocity, then these spacings are not asymmetrical or not uneven. It would be completely uniform, the spacing between these circles of red here. Okay, and the same on the blue side, it would be completely uniform, the spacing, whereas in the drawing, it's just a rough drawing here. So for a constant velocity, they would be even spacings. And the speed of light is the same, but velocity equals frequency times wavelength. So the longer the wavelength, such as the red light, for example, the frequency times wavelength is the speed of light. The longer the wavelength, the smaller the frequency is. In other words, the less frequently these pulses need to be emitted to achieve the speed of light. But it's always the speed of light. It's always the same. That is the that's Einstein's postulate, too, is that this is his one postulate from which all of special relativity came, is that the speed of light is the same for all observers. It's never different in any case from the speed c. And the problem that comes up here, that where it appears like, well, the light, since this light source is moving, as we saw, it was appearing to be catching up to the light. So therefore, from our viewpoint, doesn't that mean that the speed of light is less than the speed of light? Less than the normal speed of light as we're looking at this light source, because that source is moving so fast along with the light and reducing the relative speed of light. But that's where the Lorentz contraction comes in, that a moving frame of reference looks to us as contracted. So the light travels, has less distance that it's trying to travel in that same time. And so, you know, even though it takes longer to get there, it's traveling less distance, and so the speed of light stays the same. So there's time dilation and the Lorentz contraction both happening at the same time, which makes sure that the speed of light is the same. Now, there's no Lorentz contraction in our frame, but that's a different case. If we were in the frame of the moving source of light looking at us, we would see our frame is also contracted. It works both ways, and we would see our time as dilated from the viewpoint of that moving frame also. But that gets complicated unless we're looking at specific cases and giving examples. Then we can explain it, how it works. But the speed of light's always the same, though, even though it looks like in this case you could say it's a reduced speed of light, since the light is moving always at the same speed relative to everything, and in this case the source is moving along with the light. Anyway, I think I just got myself into a little bit of more trouble trying to explain it. But this was this whole discovery that we talked about yesterday was about how scientists discovered first after the 1920 year in the Common Era, 1920, that after that year, they discovered that the universe had more than one galaxy and that all the galaxies were moving away from each other at this enormous velocity, so that the light coming from them was red shifted, because that's what happens when something's moving away, causes a red shift. But the other thing was that was unbelievable, incredible, couldn't be explained, is that the further away the galaxy was, the faster it was moving. That was Hubble's law, and discovered by Edwin Hubble. But the fact that, and by the way, the original Cepheid stars that were discovered, they were discovered by Henrietta Leavitt, and that enabled a determination of how far away something was based on if we could find anyone could find a Cepheid star in that cluster of stars, then it would be possible to say how far away it was. And we talked about that yesterday. You have to take a known Cepheid star that's close by so you can get an absolute idea of how bright the star is, and then you can use the inverse square law so that for anything a certain distance away, if the distance equals d, then it's 1 over d squared is how that brightness decreases. So you can, using that estimate of that's not an estimate, that's a calculation, an exact calculation of how the illumination decreases with distance. So using that exact relation, you could get the estimation by looking at these distant stars, estimate how far away it is, you know, requiring that Cepheid star has to fit on that line that was discovered, that graph that was discovered by Henrietta, the relationship discovered for the Cepheid stars between the frequency and their relative brightness, that was discovered by Henrietta Leavitt. So it inevitably led to this issue that was proposed, but I think it was by Freeman, wasn't it? I'm trying to remember his name. Well, the parallax method only works out to a certain distance, so to get the stars further away than that distance, the law of Leavitt's law, that is, established by Henrietta Leavitt, was used. And that was, therefore, you could give the distance, not the date, but the distance for any star, if it was a Cepheid star. No, using a known Cepheid that was within the parallax range as the calibration, right? So using its brightness, you could then make sure that that star fell on the same graph that was established by Henrietta Leavitt. And when you did that, you'd know how far away the Magellanic clouds were, which were the clouds she used for her calculation, right? And then you could then actually establish how far away any, even without doing that, you could, because she had already established the relative relationship, you could find out for any Cepheid star anywhere how far away it was. And that's when they started finding out there were more galaxies, and the number of galaxies, you know, was huge. But before that, they couldn't detect how far away anything was. It was just all these stars, right? But using the Cepheid stars and the calibration graph of Henrietta Leavitt, they got this amazing picture that now there are many galaxies and they're far away. But the further away they were, the faster they were moving, as Edwin Hubble found. So because they were moving faster, the further away they got, that didn't make any sense, because they would have to be accelerating. In other words, the further away it got, it was going faster and then faster and faster and faster. That doesn't make any sense unless there's a force, according to Newton. Sir Isaac Newton, there'd have to be a force, but according to Einstein, there'd have to be either a large mass attracting it or curving the space-time in such a way that, or a large energy out there that would cause it to keep accelerating, right? The other way of looking at it is to just say that space itself is expanding. And the reason that explains it is because if you look at space as a grid, you see, if it's getting at the center here where the Milky Way, this is supposed to be the Milky Way galaxy, I believe, the Milky Way galaxy in the center. If one of these squares is doubling in size, that means, you know, let's say every hour it gets twice as big. That would, if it were 10 miles, it would be then, if it were, you know, if it were if something were moving 10 miles per hour and the square got doubled because the space got bigger, it would now be moving 20 miles per hour, if you can picture, if everything got bigger, right? It would now be moving 20 miles per hour instead of 10 miles per hour. Okay? But that's doubled. But if you were 10 squares out, right, you're doubling and becoming 20 squares, so you're increasing the velocity by 10 times 10 miles, you know, which is a lot. So it's now, the further out it gets, you know, like, or just look at it as a 10, for example, a 10% increase. If the velocity is increasing by 10%, it's just, I'm finding it hard to explain, but I got the understanding of it for myself yesterday, but I'm having trouble explaining it. But if everything is just expanding, you see, let's say a percentage, I mean, one, you know, 10% of 100 is 10, but 10% of 10 is 1. So you see, for the things that are more distant, their size is increasing more in not in percentage terms, but in absolute terms, right? 10% of 100 is 10 instead of 1. So it's now, because it's expanding, it's moving, in other words. It's like it's moving 10 times faster after that expansion. It's a 10 times, or it's moved 10 times further, therefore its velocity is 10 times faster, if you see what I mean. So this is the simple way to explain, if space is just expanding, it explains how everything is moving away from us, and the further away it is, the faster it's moving. That's the simplest way to explain it, but it comes about also, originally, the whole idea of, it doesn't violate Einstein's theory of relativity, that's the thing. And the Doppler shift we showed also is consistent with Einstein's theory of the postulate that light is the same. It's just a postulate that light is the same for all observers. If you can find a better postulate, then you can do that. But fire, coming to our article, The Arc of Urartu now, let's come back to The Arc of Urartu, Part 2, Chapter 12, Paragraph 11, the second last paragraph, the penultimate paragraph of our article, prior to the notes that might come after. There might be some notes. And this is chapter 12. We're talking about the Ark of Urartu, or the Noah's Ark. And it had landed, as you recall, on the mountains of Ararat in Turkey. Shall we begin reading in chapter 12, paragraph 11? Fire would have been an important commodity in those early days after the ark had landed on the Mount Kordu. The wood of the ark would have been equally so. For use as fuel for fires and in the construction of dwellings, more permanent than the tent in which Noah at first lived. Autumn months in the mountains of eastern Turkey are cold, judging from the northern latitude and the exposed height. The ark site, at 39.425 degrees north and 44.24 degrees east, made for a location where fire and shelter would be imperative, especially at the time of year that the ark landed. We dated the deluge as December 7th, Julian, 3282 BCE. This was in an earlier article. Probably in the Moses article, I think, is where we dated that. Let's see, what's the reference there? Reference 3? Moses. Yeah, it was in the Moses article. The link might be broken, but it's the article's out there. Because it now has parts. The article has parts to it now. So the old army wrote, look at, listen to this. And the ark landed that next autumn, the autumn of 3281 BCE, right? But we're now saying, wait a minute, okay, that may not be exactly right in our later articles. We say it's a little different in our later articles. I think what we're saying is more like January. Not even sure what year January of the 3282 or January of 3281, but it's somewhere close to this date that we later on propose. But I mean, the beauty of this date is it's November 11th Gregorian, which is Remembrance Day, right? This date, December 7th Julian, 3282. The way in which we arrive at the later, different date, I think it's in Preservation, if I'm not mistaken. Do I have the article Preservation here? Where are we looking? Let's see. Preservation, yeah. Let's look at 3282. Right? Seems to be. Let's look at January. January 17th in that article. I think it's something to do with that. January 17th. Yeah. So there it is. In the preservation article, we talk about it as January 1st. So it's about 11 months earlier that we're proposing in the preservation article. That's in chapter 8, paragraph 11 of the preservation article. Is that right? Let's see what else we got. Is it anywhere else? I thought it was earlier in that article. What's the name of paragraph 8? Anyway, what else are we talking about? Let's look at that again. Yeah, Phaophi 27, that's right. We talk about the Bible's reference to the dates also. So that's the one, I think, paragraph 811 of Preservation. That article is where we also have a different analysis of this. It's still 3282 BCE, same year. But the ark landed in the autumn, right? So it'd be pretty cold, or in that cold time of year. Either way, the old army road that runs through Nakhchivan runs right past where the ark originally left its imprint. That's a fascinating thing. There's still a road there, and it at some point became an army road, but it was an old road, and maybe it was there right from the very beginning, because it leads one to think it was at first the wood supply road. The altitude is 7,400 feet, which is about 900 feet higher than where the ark remains are today after sliding with mud flow down the slopes of this mountain, which is called Mashu, or we saw also in the Bible it's called Misha. And the amazing similarity of those two names just proves the identity of those two. Slopes in northwest Nakhchivan are Masher Dag, Doomsday Slope, that is. Yeah, so Masher has to do with Doomsday. And that's like the deluge, right? It was Doomsday when the deluge struck, according to what the Bible tells us, and we've found the evidence, you know, to back it up. And also the other slope is Masher Dag, which is Resurrection Slope. So Masher with an ER is Doomsday Slope. Masher Dagg with an ER in Masher is Doomsday Slope. But Masher Dagg with a UR in Masher is Resurrection Slope, interestingly. And these two slopes are in northwest Naxuan, below the city ruins. Mr. Deal estimates that about 1,000 house foundations have been identified. And the landing place is near the center of the city, which later became only graveyards. There's a city there. Or there was at one time, and later it became graveyards. And so they built a city after the Ark landed, is the implication. Later, eventually, they moved away from there to other locations when the water had gone lower and they didn't have to live up on the mountain. But it became a place for graves to bury the dead. Bury their dead. I mean, it's all, to me, every time I read this, it's like I'm reading it for the first time. There's never enough time to analyze or to think about all of the different things involved here. The twin peaks of Mashu, now Ziaret and Al Judi, look north-northeast and east-southeast, and were called breasts by Gilgamesh, states Mr. Deal. And we have a translation, there are three of them actually, different translations of a portion of the Epic of Gilgamesh. The first one says, it's by William Muss Arnold, 1901, it says, as he came to the mountain of Mashu, whose entrance is guarded daily by monsters, whose back extends to the dam of heaven, and whose breast reaches down to Aralu, scorpion men guard its gate. That's the end of that quote. The second one is from the Assyrian International News Agency. Their translation is, quote, so at length Gilgamesh came to Mashu, the great mountains about which he had heard many things, which guard the rising and the setting sun. Its twin peaks are as high as the wall of heaven, and its paps reach down to the underworld. At its gate the scorpions stand guard. That's the end of that quote. And then we have the third translation from, it's called the Complete Academic Translation by R. Campbell Thompson, 1928, page 64. Quote, as he reached the mountains of Mashu, where every day they keep watch o'er rising, unto the zenith of heaven their summits, and downwards deep unto hell reach their breasts, and there at their portals stand sentry scorpion men. Scorpion men is hyphenated, by the way, in both the first and the third translations in which those renderings occur. Okay, that's it for those three translations of that small part from the Epic of Gilgamesh, showing that this mountain that was called Mashu was regarded as having breasts because of its twin peaks, which were called Ziaret and Al Judi, according to what we read in the sentence just prior to the quotes. So that's it. That's the end of our study for today. That was chapter 12, paragraph 11. It's in part 2 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, the article from 2011. We've got 8 minutes and some few seconds remaining that we could talk about things. What do I want to talk about? I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, right. Okay, so there's, yeah. Well, now, yeah, people are talking about, for example, trying to do tests for cancer, right? People do tests for cancer. That, to me, is a very last-ditch sort of attempt to help someone, right? It's, if you wait till you get cancer before you start doing tests, or if you wait that long, it strikes me as virtually without any hope, right? I mean, it's a last minute thing, whereas you could be every day pursuing your health, trying to, not just trying to, but deliberately doing everything so as to avoid cancer. I mean, cancer is not something you should be waiting to receive. Like, that's not the idea. And then, I mean, all these sophisticated technologies that can be implemented to try to find a cure for cancer, that's just it's clueless is what it is. It's a clueless approach. Instead of understanding what cancer really is, which is sort of the last thing. And I mean, we probably all have cancer in our bodies anyway. That's not really the point. The point is, are we successfully countering, you know, curing it, healing it? Are we defeating the cancer every day by what we're eating and how we're living? And I mean, for some people, I mean, if they're going to wait till they get cancer, well, there's a lot of things that could kill you before you get cancer too, before you even get that sick, because you've got other, you know, life-threatening conditions brought about because of bad eating habits and all these things. You know, it's all about how you eat and how you treat your body and how you respect your body, or otherwise, in many cases where people don't respect their bodies, and then they think they can find a cure for whatever. It doesn't have to be cancer. Whatever the disease is, they think they can find a cure for it. And they're going to leverage this immense amount of money, is the idea. There's talk about putting $500 billion into finding a cure for everything and, you know, these kinds of things. I mean, that's treating illness, but it sounds like to me, like, I mean, if you have to wait to go to the doctor, that, you know, to have an answer to the problem that you've got, at that point it's almost too late. I mean, and you're throwing a huge amount of money. Like, they're throwing vast amounts of money thinking they can solve the problem with money. To me, that is almost inconceivably stupid. But I understand how it makes people feel good to spend money. I understand how that works, and how I understand how it makes them feel like they're doing something really constructive, and that, you know, that they can solve these things. It's just, it's such the wrong approach. It's so much, so futile to my way of thinking, that it's ridiculous from my viewpoint. I see that, yeah, I mean, why? I see that it makes them feel good and all that, but it's not to think they're going to be able to do these things. But it's such a waste and such a huge error in the approach, where what we should do every day is think of our life as very precious and only put the best things into our body, not junk food, not fast food from, or not even food from other people, not even restaurant food, not even food that we don't prepare ourselves, not processed food. You know, we should be trying to avoid all of that, but trying to get natural food, you know, that, and preparing food ourselves. And I mean, obviously we're not perfect. I mean, Lord knows I'm not perfect, but I mean, I have canned food, I have things like that. I mean, canning is a way to, you know, preserve food in the wintertime, for example, when you can't get food as easily if you can't get out to the store. Nowadays, though, we've got fresh food at all the supermarkets, virtually everywhere. So that's, if you can get out to the store, it's not a very big problem to be able to get it. But of course, keeping it on hand is the problem in the winter. And that's what, well, refrigerate, or in the summer. Or in the summer, especially in the summer, it's hard to keep food because it's, you know, that's why the invention of the refrigerator was such a great thing, right? But food, okay? Every day, orthomolecular things, that's the thing. Not finding artificial treatments, but orthomolecular treatments. But you can't do it after you've got the, I mean, you have to do it yourself. Because you can see what your symptoms are. So each person has to be learning every day, it seems to me. I mean, there's no question that somebody else as a physician who has experience can help, right? But the problem with consulting them is then you tend to relinquish responsibility and you just pass it to someone else. The responsibility lies with each person to pursue health every day. And I know it's hard to give up certain foods and certain addictions to sugar and all these different addictions that we have to food. That's very difficult, but that's what we need to be pursuing, is finding the best way to start to naturally work on improving our bodies so that our bodies want to eat the good food, and we want to nurture our bodies. And everything we eat, we should be considering whether it's a cure for cancer or something going towards cancer, you know, causing cancer. We want to avoid that, cancer and cancer-causing things. We want to go toward things that are curative, that heal cancer. And if we do that in everything we eat, we're always aware of what could be leading to disease, not just cancer, of course, but everything. If we're continually educating ourselves, then that's when we have the best opportunity to avoid all of this healthcare system, which we don't really want to be a part of at all. That's the best approach, right? Now we can use that. Oh yeah, that AI is great because if it's put online for us, we can use it to do our research. If we can research our own health condition using that artificial intelligence, that's great. And we can already do that, but that's only going to get better, I hope. And that's the way we should be able to do it, is learning and studying and hopefully having the information. But that's it for today. It's January 22nd, 2025, of the Common Era, and the time is 21:47 hours Canadian Eastern Time. I love you very much. I'm Ward Green, and thank you so much for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. That was chapter 12, paragraph 11 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, that we studied today. And a little bit of, again, of the expanding universe explanation. And you can watch that video, too, by Mahesh. And I'll see you next time.